nice for me to be back after being gone for a month. And it seems that you all have been talking about the precepts last month. At least some of you, those of you who have been coming. And I thought I would just say a few things about them and then hear from you. And then we'll have kind of a discussion until about 8:15, and then we could end the evening with 15 minutes more of sitting. Is there anything that, before I start, is there anything that's pressing or that needs to be brought up that you want to ask at this point or give you a chance? Anything?
I would just like to say that even though our speakers who spoke in your place were really very marvelous, but there is that the empty part of me that's only maybe fleeting missed you. Mm. The other part that clings stubbornly to an independent self. I'm not sure, but I just wanted to welcome you back.
Thank you, thank you. What I thought of doing was just maybe talk a little more generally about precepts. In particular, since this is really a beginning class in meditation, beginning kind of supposed to be at least. See all these old timers here. I thought of just saying a few things about about the connection between meditation practice, mindfulness practice, and the precepts. I'll say some things kind of as an introduction, but what I would like to ask you when I finish my introduction is to ask you all what you think, very personally, aside from what you maybe hear from me, but what you feel is the connection between your own meditation practice, your own mindfulness practice, and the ethical life, living a virtuous life. In Buddhism, we talk about the five precepts: not to kill, and not to steal, and not to lie, not to misuse sexuality, and not to misuse intoxicants. And there is a tradition in Buddhism that the precepts are a very joyful thing in people's lives. And that there are Buddhists who love the precepts, who take delight in not only the idea of the precepts, but delight in their own embodiment of the precepts and of ethical virtue, virtuous conduct. And so for me, this was kind of a surprise when I first was studying Buddhism, because for me, growing up in the West at the time that I did, there was a kind of a aversion to precepts, to anything that talked about precepts, anything looked like shoulds, anything that you should be doing with your life. It felt like an external imposition and something that limited your life rather than kind of expressed the freedom of your life. And sometimes there was an abhorrence among my friends for such things as precepts. So to come across these Buddhists who really delighted in it, and they would rejoice in precepts and were very happy in their own, as I said, embodiment of the precepts, was a surprise for me. And I think there is a joyful connection between mindfulness practice and the precepts. Someone pointed out to me recently, for a long time I'd heard about, you shouldn't should your life, which is kind of, you can't really say it even. There's a difference between shoulds and coulds. And there's the things we could do, and there's the things we should do. And sometimes we confuse the two. But what things we could do are things that are within our potential, our possibility, that maybe we want to do, maybe kind of expresses some deeper potential for who we are, and it can be healthy and whole and healthy and wholesome to try to align yourself or to grow into that possibility. And I think the precepts are one of those. They're not supposed to, they're not shoulds, but they're certainly coulds. And part of the rejoicing, part of the joy that some people feel about them, the precepts, is that when you live a life according to the precepts, an ethical life, it allows you to walk through life without having to be ashamed, without feeling any shame. You can be kind of independent and open and receptive and vulnerable to the world and not have to worry about someone thinking bad about you or attacking you or feeling your own shame. Or you don't have to turn your eyes away from anybody. You can be equal to anybody that you meet. You don't have to kind of look down or kind of crawl around the sides, avoid people, or in all the kind of ways in which we might do that. You can actually meet someone directly, and you have nothing to hide, and you have nothing. You can just be there, and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to be brilliant or anything. But just you are complete, and you have nothing. You haven't made yourself incomplete by breaking precepts, and that's a wonderful thing. People to go through life with this kind of openness, that of a clear conscience. I talked this week with a woman who's been practicing mindfulness practice for about a year now, fairly intensively for the last 6 months, intensely every day for about 45 minutes every day, very, very regularly. And she's taken real delight in the practice, in the mindfulness practice. And she says in the last month or two, she's found that she's becoming really open-hearted. And she's never been so open-hearted before. And all these people, like her friends that she usually knows, it's, the relationships are working so much nicer. And she, strangers she meets, and somehow it resonates. You know, her open-heartedness kind of is contagious, I guess. People get, so it's very, her life's been very nice. She doesn't know hardly anything about Buddhism and just came to one retreat. And then I kind of knew almost what she was going to say next. She had all this open-heartedness and feelings of intimacy with one of her old friends who wasn't her husband. And the passion, sexual passion, rose dramatically. And she, her husband was out of town for that week. So what, you know, what to do? You know, she, you know, and she was kind of, you know, she was kind of beside herself. What to do with all this energy and all this, you know, open-heartedness? And luckily, she didn't do anything except try to cope the best she could. And then she called me, and I explained to her. Well, I said, this is a very important lesson that Buddhist practice, the mindfulness practice, in a Buddhist context, is always held in the container of the precepts. And one of the ways that makes the practice safe, to open up to all the stuff that can arise in the course of the practice, is you're gently being held within this wonderful container, this bowl of the precepts. And it's safe to let things come up, energies and feelings and fantasies and all, but you can explore them and deepen your connection with yourself by holding it within the precepts, so it means not acting on them. So she could feel that open-heartedness and explore it and get to know it. If she'd acted on it, it would have been a disaster in her situation. She was completely happy with her husband. It wasn't like, you know, she was looking for someone else. And often what happens in a spiritual life is there is a kind of open-heartedness that happens. And it's very easy, that open-heartedness, to fall in love with people. And I don't know if it's just our culture, maybe it's universal, but there's a close connection between open-heartedness, feelings of intimacy, and sexuality. And a lot of people confuse the two. So expressions of intimacy, kind of open-heartedness, can be confused as being sexual interest or sexual kind of thing going on. And then you follow the wrong route, just the wrong fork. You take another kind of a detour for a while, rather than following the increasing opening of the heart, increasing deepening into our own integrity and deeper sincerity. So I think it's important to say that you know that the precepts are a very important container for the practice. Well, I was going to tell you, maybe I won't say what I think the joy of, or the connection between meditation, mindfulness practice, and precepts is any more than what I've said. It would be interesting to hear from you what you guys think. Is what do you think the connection is between them? In a personal way, if you've ever reflected on it. And some of you have been talking about it for the last month, so you might have some thoughts. Yeah?
You have to be mindful to even be aware of the precept.
You have to be blindfold?
Mindful. like a precept I work with my some of my colleagues at work, constantly work with. This isn't part of the five precepts, it's part of the 10 Mahayana precepts of not talking about other people and elevating yourself.
Uh-huh.
And you'll be carrying on a conversation, and one of us will say what we're doing, you know, and then we'll catch ourselves. But you really have to be mindful to, because it's so ingrained in our behavior, so it requires a fair amount of mindfulness to be aware you're doing.
Well, there's a couple of things about that. One is, it's really great to have a group of people who are doing it together with you, because they can help you catch it, and it becomes kind of a kind of a fun thing. You know, rather than kind of moralistic, say, "You look what you did." It's like they wink at you and you say, "Oh yeah, oh yeah."
Yeah, but the next statement is, "Oh, we're having so much fun doing it."
And the other thing about mindfulness. You need to be mindful. Sure, you need to be mindful, but taking on the precepts as a voluntary thing to take on is also then an aid to become mindful. And one of the monastic delights. If you ever want to try Buddhist monasticism for a while, it's a temporary thing. You can do it just for a few months. You don't have to do a lifetime commitment. So you can try it out for size. It's kind of fun. But one of the delights of being a monk or a nun. Is which surprised me also. I thought, when I became a monk, was what surprised me was that as a monk, you have to follow 227 precepts, not just 10 or 5. But in order to follow them, you have to be really mindful. And so it really sharpened my mindfulness. But not simply in being mindful. Well, I don't want to give away too much. But anyway, so taking on the precepts helps you become mindful. And becoming mindful can help you live a more ethical life. Yeah.
I feel like my greatest struggle is self-judgment and criticism.
Uh-huh.
And I really have struggled with mindfulness. I become more mindful about judgmental and myself. And then the precepts I really have trouble with, because at my worst, I start to feel like the Antichrist or something. I break them all the time.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not quite sure what to do. I may feel uncomfortable even.
Oh, the more mindful you are, the more your mindfulness mature, the more you realize you're breaking them all the time. But
now I feel guilty about killing snails and little white lies and, it's on the scale of things. It's all kind of harmless in a way.
In taking on the precepts, I mean, this is one of the things that it does. It helps you see your tendencies. So a tendency towards guilt is a tendency towards aversion to hate, and so learning you have that potential within that possibility, that trait, you can begin exploring what are the dynamics around guilt,
because
guilt is kind of is a form of aversion or a form of hate. And so you get to explore that and try to work with it in a skillful way to try to make it less of a painful thing for you. So it doesn't torment you so much. And that's considered to be a healthy move. I mean, we can put you someplace where you're not going to break any precepts at all. And you'll never learn anything about yourself. And we're trying to wake up to some real deeper potential of who we are, of what reality is. And of course, at times, what it means is confronting the places where we hold ourselves in. So then mindfulness practice is working with that in a skillful and compassionate and friendly way.
That's
That's the hard part. Yeah, it's not easy. It's easy to talk about up here, you know. It's, it's not, you know. And so then we do loving kindness practice. Get the habit of it. Get the hang of it. And it is hard. And so mindfulness practice, if you allow the mindfulness practice to really, if you really apply yourself in mindfulness practice and this, and really be able to go deeply into those tendencies, you'll see something deeper behind it. And that'll help loosen that entanglement that you find yourself in when you're in the middle of it. So there's usually, simplistically, there's kind of two general ways to work with some of the things you're trying to deal with, and it's not easy. And one is to try to cultivate an attitude of friendliness and compassion for yourself, and to see yourself as being as worthy. Of friendship, friendliness, as all those other people outside of you are, because we're not any different. So realize that and then direct that toward yourself. The other way is to bring this very clear and consistent mindfulness to what's going on. What is happening when you're guilty? What are the feelings? How do you feel it in your body? What happens there? What's the movement there? Where does that movement of aversion arise out of? What is a judgment that is happening at that time? What is this below that? Maybe there's a sense of almost any kind of self-loathing, self-aversion, guilt arises out of a sense of hurt. And often that hurt is buried underneath a lot of guilt. And the guilt can be so strong you don't see the hurt. So if you can really learn the ability and mindfulness to be there with the guilt, without pushing it away or holding on to it or judging it any more than you are, then at some point you might see where the guilt is arising out of. And if you can see that, then there maybe is a chance of healing that. So, but it's a slow process and it takes time. And but I think bringing it up and being willing to talk about it in a group like this, I think is actually a very healthy and healing part of the whole process, because you're being honest about it. most of us aren't that honest, and so if you're not honest, you can't be free. Yeah.
Listening to the precepts last week, I had the feeling that it gave me a trustful confidence, much better confidence in what was happening in sitting.
Ah.
The stuff that would come up in my sitting sometimes were pretty bizarre, and somehow the precepts was like a little, kind of like a loosely woven net that I could fall into, but it only has five.
I'll give you more.
Sorry, I was thinking about your 220 book. But I found that the meditations were safer. They allowed me to go a little deeper, so that the next time, well, in fact, they allowed me a little more realization too, uh-huh. as well, and so the cycle kind of gets better. That's how I.
Oh, I think it's beautiful. That's kind of what I was saying before about a container, but you said it so well. So that it's more trust. You feel it's maybe it's more trust. You can trust yourself more to open up to what's going on, because you're not to worry about, well, am I going to punch out my neighbor, or am I going to act on it or something? And you know that you can. It's okay to experience all that and all those motivations and feelings, because you know you have the precepts which are going to hold you. Is that, I think it's fantastic. Does anybody else feel that way? Anybody thought about that way or feel that way about them?
Yeah.
No? Yes?
A year ago, I was made aware of the five, and I took four of them actually. I left the one about drinking out because I didn't get money to kind of share with them. But one of them that I didn't expect to make a lot of difference was the killing one, and I stopped killing a lot of insects that I used to kill, as well as snails. And I felt kind of glad that I wasn't doing that, and then I felt kind of proud. And then recently I was made aware of 12, and they were rather complicated, and they're very overwhelming.
These are the Thich Nhat Hanh precepts?
Pardon?
12? I don't know, it's 12. Unless it's Thich Nhat Hanh.
I don't know. One of them was something about watching what you say, how you say it, how will. Whatever I say will be helpful, will be kind, and will be useful, and will be something, you know. And then, so when you open your mouth, you know, how can you possibly think that this kind is helpful? They were just, you know. So then the suggestion was made to just take one insignificant part of one precept and just do that, just work on that, or be aware of that. Oh, another one was never turn away from suffering, always look it in the eyes. There's
so many
opportunities to do that. Yeah. One was not hoard your wealth, and, you know, you have to hoard my wealth.
Yeah.
So it's really tricky. And you feel, I kind of
feel that. Yeah. The thing about pride is interesting, because pride is a feeling and an attitude which tends to certainly it creates division between people, and that's part of the danger of it, it's me against the rest. But in Buddhism, it's considered to be a virtue to delight and rejoice in your ability to follow the precepts. So you can give up the pride, but not the joy in the fact that you're doing it. So isn't that kind of nice?
That is.
If you can separate the two.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And also, you know, Buddhism doesn't have this God that's watching you. So, you know, it's okay to have some guilt and some pride and all these things. I mean, we're human beings, and we're just kind of working with stuff we have the best we can. We don't make it worse than it is. And the thing about the precepts, there are a lot of precepts, actually. And there's the five precepts, and the eight precepts, and the 10 precepts, and I guess the 12 precepts, and there's, you know, 27 precepts, and there's more. You know, there's all these different precepts. And rather than taking them on as a should, as we feel what our intention is in our practice, the possibility in the practice, what we're working with, that your practice should always come from you, in a sense, that you feel this is something that your spiritual practice is being motivated from some your own personal intention, and not some kind of abstract ideal or status quo or kind of peer pressure or whatever. So as you're doing that, as you're finding ways, and so what you do is you find your deep intention, and then you try to bring your mindfulness practice to bear on that deep intention. And then you might go to sometimes on a retreat, or you might go to a teacher and talk to the teacher about how the teacher can help you do the thing you're trying to do for yourself. So the teacher is not imposing it, the teacher is an aid. Everything's aiding this deep intention. So in relationship to the precepts, there are all these precepts. And the thing is to see what is the connection between whatever these different precepts and your own natural desire to wake up and be present and be compassionate. And you might see for yourself, if I try out this one particular precept, that actually, rather than kind of being assured that I'm imposed and be guilty, this actually might help me become more awake. So I'll try it on for a while. And you try another one, then 1 week, and another week, another one. Or so it becomes an easy thing rather than trying to remember all these lists. And so your way was great. It was very nice. Yes?
I have a question about the precept about not killing.
Yeah.
It's, ironically, it seems whenever I hear it discussed by various people, it deals with, mainly with insects.
For American Buddhists, that's the thing that seems to be most closely at hand. Yes.
Or
killing your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking that probably.
Yeah. So what you're pointing out is something I think is very important, is that the literal meaning of the precepts are easy to understand for sure, and it's relatively easy to kind of in the most direct, obvious way for most people to follow them. Most of us aren't going out killing other people, killing animals. Other people kill animals for us, you know. most obvious things is pretty easy. But as you become more sensitive, more mindful, and also start thinking about and reflecting on it, begin seeing that these also apply to other areas that are more maybe metaphoric or more analogies. I don't know what the right word is. And that's a beautiful example, because you can kill someone else's intention, or kill someone else's joy, or kill someone else's goodwill or generosity or many things, and your own. So, so then you become sensitive to a whole different level. And so the deeper level of working with the precepts is working with that. If you interrupt someone in a conversation, you've stolen something. Maybe that's one way of seeing it, and so there's that level, and that's where I kind of said earlier that the more mindful you are, the more you realize you can never really, you're always breaking them, because you start seeing there's more deeper and deeper, kind of more and more subtle levels, and until finally, you know, you know it's yes.
At that level of subtlety, the interconnections between the precepts become quite evident. Well, they do on a grosser level too. I mean, if you cloud your mind in one way, you're going to cloud it in another, and if you break a precept and are aware of the breaking of it, I think it reflects in the other precepts as well. I'm not explaining this very well, but what my question is, since there are greatly more precepts than the five that laymen follow, does that interconnection continue on down the line, and does the net that you were speaking of become more filled in? I'm not sure that sleeping on a on a high bed or handling money is of the same degree of subtlety as the first five.
Oh. For a monk or a nun, some of the precepts are what we would in English would call maybe ethical, but a lot of them are simply training rules. So you do this because it's the training, or back in ancient India there was some association. For example, in ancient India, if you I read today, for example, this is one of them, is you're not allowed to give a Dharma talk to someone who's holding an umbrella. That's one of the rules. And the reason, the explanation, the commentary is that in ancient India, 2,500 years ago, that having an umbrella was a status symbol. And so if you're holding the umbrella, you're holding your status symbol, and you shouldn't speak to someone who is flaunting their status. So they should at least not hold it, they can put it in their lap or something, or put it down. And So that has more to do with customs of the times rather than you know, any. Or there's a kind of. But I think that's a separation. Some of them, a lot of them, are not ethical. They have to do with customs of the time, and they have to do with training precepts to help you with your training. When I was ordained as a monk, I hadn't been ordained more than maybe 5 or 6 hours, and this most senior monk came to me and said, "You have to confess for breaking the precepts." And this guy was a trip. You know, he had a kind of Calvinistic maybe mentality, maybe. And the reason I had to confess was one of the rules is your robes have to always be lined up, kind of neat. And my robes were little, you know, these robes aren't, you know, just, you're wearing, you know, bed sheets, kind of, right? And so you're kind of constantly kind of falling off and getting loose. And so, of course, they're going to kind of get a little bit crooked and kind of, and so, but it's one of the rules, you have to keep them always straight. So he wanted me to confess. But the connection between them, I think they overlap. One, I wrote a document recently on ethics, and I said in it that the precept of not lying is particularly important, because often when you break the other precepts, you're also breaking that one. So if you just maintain that one, you're less likely to break the others. Yes?
I've got a question that sort of goes to how we could practice or should practice. And when you were speaking earlier to her about self-loathing, for example,
yeah,
and maybe we can use that to deepen our practice and go in and maybe follow the threads of that and under something. But a question that I have has to do with, say, anger.
Uh-huh.
And the question more specifically is, if I'm feeling angry, in terms of what we're doing here, is it a good idea to just sit down and meditate on it and really try to get in touch with the anger and what's there? Or do I write about it? Or do I talk about it? Or all of the above?
I think you have to. Each situation has to be taken on its own terms. So, in terms of the meditation practice is to simply sit with the anger, allow it to be there, not to repress it or push it away, but don't act on it either. There's the wonderful balance between the two. So you really get to know it really well, without adding complications to it. And when it's really strong or very, very repetitive, kind of like a thing that comes up and over and over again, sometimes that's enough. You can go really deep and clarify it. Sometimes it doesn't seem to be enough for some people, and it still causes so much pain and suffering that you just don't want to continue with so much pain. Sometimes writing is a great way. Writing is kind of like, or speaking to a friend is a wonderful way of kind of doing mindfulness out loud, which is very powerful. The way in which kind of part of mindfulness is acknowledging what we're experiencing, what's going on for us. Acknowledgement has a way of both clarifying and settling things, taking care of them. It takes some of the strength away from them, maybe. Talking out loud to a friend can be a very powerful way of acknowledging something fully. And some things seem to be really best acknowledged if you do it to someone else. That's why in Buddhism, in ancient Buddhism, there was a whole tradition of what's been translated into English as confession. And I think part of the value of that was not because you have to go and confess your sins, because there's no sins in Buddhism, but some things are best taken care of by verbally acknowledging with someone else. And I think a lot of the benefit of therapy is aside from whatever skills a therapist has, you know, in terms of working with you, is simply the therapy is a place where you can actually vocalize and acknowledge out loud what's going on. So all the above, I think, depending on the situation. And then also to be discerning about the anger, because the Buddhist tendency, because we're focusing so much on practice, and practice is a big part of practice, so internal, Buddhists, the tendency for Buddhists is always to see, well, what is my role in this? How did I respond and act in this situation? And how can I? So it's like I've had encounters with other Buddhists where we kind of had kind of this little difficulty. And then I go home and I thought about it for a while and I said, gee, you know, I was really made a mistake there, didn't I? And then I called up and said, you know, I want to apologize for, you know, for what I did. Oh, I was going to call you and apologize for what I did. You know, I feel so responsible, you know. And because Buddhists, it's a trait, it's a beautiful trait, I think, of Buddhists, is to always go see what was my responsibility in this thing. But you can go too far. And that's the danger in Buddhism also. It's a beauty, but also a danger among some Buddhists, is there's this hesitation among true blue Buddhists. I don't know. To see clearly what's happening outside of your responsibility sometimes it's too much internal. And sometimes you need to act in a situation and say something to someone else and say no, or say, let's talk about it, or let's have a mediator, or something has to happen besides just your own stuff. And is that enough, you think? Within the next 2 months, I plan on giving a talk, I think probably Monday night, on anger. It seems like it's time. It's, you know, it's been long enough now, and it's it's one of the most popular topics. And someone will always disagree with me. I've been trying for years to give a talk on anger that Brigitte doesn't take exception to. And I hope I never succeed. So, yes?
I was going to say, it must be all the hot weather
again. Could be, yes. Oh, this is interesting. Oh, excuse me, if I may say, I was going to... This is a random thought, footnote to that. I live up on Skyline, the 2,000 feet, so I kind of live above the smog, I think. So I was driving down today, and I was looking down in the fog across this. It's very foggy today. It's one of the thick, maybe one. And it's kind of trapped in the bay. And I was thinking about it, and I said, and I was thinking about the precepts, and especially the second precept about not stealing. And I thought there was a connection, and I said, we're generating all the smog and it's staying here where we're generating it, and for once in a rare time we're not sending it to Fresno. And if you ever go down to the Central Valley and up against the foothills there, Sierras, all the Bay Area fog goes down there and it lingers down there, and you know, out of mind, out of, you know, what did you say, out of sight, out of mind, right? So we're generating all the time, and so I don't know, is it breaking a precept to create all the smog and send it to Fresno? So I'm sorry, go ahead.
I have both a comment and a question about things that have been touched on by all the other things. When you talk about how the precepts and the meditation and mindfulness are related, it came to my mind that I'm just new to this and I don't really know the precepts except for that they're pretty common in all religions.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's very easy to see what the right thing is to do, and other times it's not so easy.
Yeah.
And I have found at times that in meditating and going inner, not so much with mindfulness but other techniques, that it becomes clearer to me what is the right thing.
Yeah.
That's my comment. Now my question is, I'm in a particular situation in my life now that things aren't very clear to me at all as to what the right thing. And a particular piece is that what seems right to another person, I have compassion and I can see their viewpoint, and I actually have more of a tendency to, oh yes, of course.
Yeah.
And then sometimes forget that, well wait, you know, this is my viewpoint, which is equally valid, and have compassion for that. So my question is, are there any thoughts, techniques, whatever that you might have that this mindfulness might help I mean, I find talking to people sometimes gets it clearer, but yeah. Nobody knows. The best thing is when I can touch into something inside of myself that knows.
Yes, yes. So I think that's beautifully said, and that's one very dramatic connection between precepts and mindfulness is, if you become, if you can become aware enough of your own deeper integrity, which often surfaces when you're quiet enough, it's a lot clearer what not only what you should do, but what you want to do. And what you don't want to do, and when you're not in touch with that integrity and you're in your surface mind. You think that's what you want to do. You know, you think, well, it's my freedom. I want to express myself, and you think that person, you know, self-expression, you know, is the right thing to do. And but it's just that surface mind which is running around like a monkey, and you end up in trouble. It's not what you really want to do. So simply practicing, having some kind of practice that helps you. There's many ways. In Buddhism, one of the guidelines to help us with these kind of things is to pay a lot of attention to our intention. And the criteria, ultimate criteria in Buddhism, is the intention behind the act. So, is the intention wholesome? If there's unwholesome aspect to the intention, then maybe you shouldn't act on it, or then you should spend more time clarifying it. But if your intention is wholesome, then you're in a safer area. And sometimes you have to be very quiet or pay very careful attention to discover what your intention is. But that has a lot to do with it, and that'll help in a lot of situations because sometimes our intention is tinged by aversion or hate or greed or fear, and when you see that, you say, oh, wait a minute, maybe I better take it a little bit slow here and look more carefully. Or you might find after a while, oh, it's not, so maybe it's now I can state it or say it or explore it some more. Part of the value of meditation practice is that it gives us a taste, maybe not immediately, but it starts giving us a taste, a feeling, or at least a hint of what it's like to be in a mind and a body without fear, without hate, without aversion, without greed, without confusion. And if you can get that taste, that feeling of what that is, you can recognize much more clearly when your mind-body experience is tinged by those things. And if you have more of a reference, and if you can see that, then maybe you can, notice when you're acting out of fear. You notice when you're acting out of aversion much more earlier. And you appreciate what it feels like to be in a place that's not acting out of fear or aversion or confusion. So one of the connections between mindfulness practice and the precepts is that the precepts are a definition, kind of how you'd act if you're acting from a place without any fear or aversion. And so if you find yourself breaking a precept, it isn't that you're breaking some moral code that's bad to break. It's showing you that you've lost touch with some part of yourself which maybe, hopefully, you value very much yourself. And so the meditation practice is about learning some part of yourself that you really value. And as you learn, as you value it more and more, the precepts become a wonderful guideline for how to stay in touch with what you love. So it's kind of so that's why the joy, the joy of the precepts is because you found something you love and enjoy within yourself. And then at some point, it isn't just personal, because at some point in the mindfulness practice, meditation practice, some of the harder boundaries we have between self and other break down, and you feel that your own what's of most value inside of you resonates with what's most of value in someone else. So you also want to honor that valuable essence or whatever of others. So you're not only living a precept because it's good for your own essence, you're living a precept because of that resonance between your own and that of other people. And that's a hopefully if you follow what I've said, you can also maybe have a sense that it actually can be joyful. And why Buddhists like to talk about precepts. So anyway, that's enough. We should sit, I think.